This week on A to Z Running, we throw back to one of our first interviews, a conversation with Coach Hodge about how to run faster without trying harder.
We also answer a listener question about how to pace a race.
In the world of running, the World Indoor Track and Field Championships was thrilling, and we've got the full scoop.
And the Tokyo Marathon was a shocker with major upsets.
All this and more on A to Z Running. Welcome back to A to Z Running, where we help runners thrive with information, inspiration, and coaching and training services. I'm Andy.
And I am Zach, and you can find out everything you need to know about everything we do at A2ZRunning.com, or follow us, or also follow us on the places where we have stuff. That's Instagram, Spotify, and YouTube primarily.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad to be back in studio.
Welcome.
Thank you. I've had a lot of travels lately, and they're not quite over yet. But I recently was in Milwaukee and had a fabulous running experience along Lake Michigan, on the other side of Lake Michigan. I could wave over to the Michiganders over there.
It doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't. But it was a beautiful running path along the water, and it got me thinking, like, I'd really like to know different cities, major cities that have good running within a couple miles of like city center. I think it'd be helpful to know these things because I can find, like, I'll Google and research a city and it's running, and but usually it's like parks surrounding the actual city itself. But I don't have a car when I go, and I'm not going to be Ubering everywhere. So I'd like to know, like, within a couple miles, up to 4 miles maybe, is there a place I can run within city center?
Yeah, I mean, like, what are the good places to run with access from the city? That's an important question. And it's like in Austin, Texas. Everyone who's local to Austin, Texas knows that there's this like perfect 10-mile loop that everyone does because it's like bike paths the whole way. You don't ever have to cross major traffic lanes, which is an incredible thing, right? That's just super uncommon. But if you're visiting Austin, Texas, it's hard to find out about that unless you happen upon it, or if you're savvy and clever, as some of us are, and you search Strava heat maps to find out where people are traveling while they're recording things on Strava. But even then, the Strava heat maps can really deceive you because you get more cyclists than runners most of the time, and that's not always the same kind of thing, where you want to ride versus where you want to run. So anyway, yes, we often find ourselves wishing we knew where good places to run would be in the cities we're visiting.
Right. And that is not exclusive to the US. Other places, like, I know some of you are listening from London or from Switzerland or in other places where there could be major cities that this could be helpful information as well for travelers. So if you have a place that you know of that you've traveled to or you live in that has good running in the city, please reach out, because I am thinking about putting together an article that identifies some of these places.
If we can find them.
If we can find enough of them to make it a good resource.
Well, speaking of things that you're sharing and that we're also sharing because you're sharing them, let's get on to your questions. Just a reminder that you should ask all your questions. And you can do that very easily by sending an email to questions@a2zrunning.com. That is the word questions, plural, because you have many, @a2zrunning.com. And one of you just recently did this, specifically one of you of the high school persuasion, which is, this is just always so much fun. When we get to
you
talk.
Can be persuaded to be from high school in high school?
No, but you can be of the high school persuasion. You're clearly misdefining my words, Andy.
Okay.
Well, so we love talking to the young runners in the world.
All runners.
Right. But in particular, there's a different kind of experience for someone who's just kind of experiencing running excitement for the first time in their lives. And it's just such a fun thing to participate in some capacity. So if you are among them, and we know that some of you are because we have spoken with a number of you, in fact. Now, this one in particular, this question comes from Addison. And Addison is beginning his freshman year of high school track, his first high school track season. How exciting,
so
Addison.
So fun.
We are thrilled for you, and we really wish you the best and hope that it goes well. And so here's the question that Addison wrote in. As my freshman high school track season starts, my goal for the 1600, for those of us who aren't high school runners anymore, that's what they do instead of the mile in the United States in high school. 1600 meters is to go sub 5 minutes. I had a time trial today, and I felt great, was on pace for around 5:10 for the first 800 meters, then kind of fell apart the last 600 or so and ended up running 5:28. I think I paced my 1600 wrong and would like to know your suggestions on how to improve my pacing to hopefully bring my 1600 meter time below 5 minutes by the end of the season and why you would pace it that way. Insightful question. Don't just tell me an answer, but tell me why. My 400 meter splits were about 73, 78, 84, 93. So you can see where that struggle began, as he articulated. And I find your podcast fascinating and helpful in my own goals. Thanks, Addison. Well, thank you, Addison. Glad to hear from you and glad that you find this helpful. So now we're going to add to the helpfulness by speaking specifically to your experience. One thing, Addison, to note here is you shared an experience that every high school runner has experienced most of the time that we race or that they race, which is you started faster and then the struggle hit earlier than you thought it would, worse than you thought it would, any of those kinds of things, and it slowed you up and you didn't quite hit what you were hoping to hit. Okay, that is a very normal experience. So if you can hack it in such a way that you defy that normal experience, you are going to be among the upper echelon of high school runners. And you can do so by following these simple tips.
That sounds so clickbaity.
Yeah. For only $19.99. Anyway, okay, so here's what we want to do, Addison. There's a couple layers here that we actually want to unpack for you. One is some of the thinking behind this, and two is the race strategy, the approach to the race itself. And there's a couple of layers to that even in that sense.
And the beginning of a season is not indicative of where you'll be at the end of the season. So it's great to have time trials. I think they're great to learn from, like you are right now. And good on you for delving into it and trying to get the most out of it by discussing it and even asking your questions. But just know that, like, what you do at the end of the season when you're peaked and when you're firing on all cylinders is gonna be different than how it feels now.
Two things tend to improve over the course of a season, among others, but these two are the most important influences on performance. One is your fitness should grow. You should be getting better physiologically over the course of the season. So yes, what is difficult now should not be difficult 2 months from now. Second, your specific race preparedness improves. And that comes from a few different layers. One is just the experience of doing it a number of times. And so you're more familiar with how hard can I go early on and still feel strong at the end? Or what do I do when things are starting to feel badly? How do I handle that in the moment? And all that kind of stuff, just experience is going to really help with that. And so don't shy away from trying things, especially early in the season, and learning from mistakes if you make them. The other side of that is your specific neuromuscular interactivity is improving every time you run at these higher aggressive levels. And especially if you're aspiring towards something like a 5 minute mile, for instance, the more times you do things that are faster or faster than that or around that, the more familiar your body is with moving at that degree, and it's just gonna be easier. So the fitness grows, the neuromuscular interactivity improves, and your experience overall is getting better. And so you're just going to be better by the end of the season than you are right now.
I feel like this is like the perfect episode for Addison to have his question on, though, because we're talking this week on near muscularity.
In fact, you should listen to the rest of the episode,
yes,
Addison,
definitely.
Because we're talking with Coach Hodge about how to do some of these things better, even if nothing else improves. You can still get better in certain ways. Of course, you want to get better in all of them. Anyway.
So one of the things that I learned from him, and this is one of the tips
from
that,
him being Coach Hodge,
yes,
not Addison.
Right. Coach Hodge, because he was my coach.
Yep.
Hence calling him Coach Hodge. He had encouraged me that I be very relaxed in the first 200 because a lot of times runners in the mile will go out way too hard. And that's like all the problems start with that.
Yeah.
And then from there, it's very difficult to continue to run fast as you're already getting anaerobic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in a mile, arguably, you're spending the whole time anaerobic to some degree in a sense. But if you overdo it early, that's right. That's definitely not good. Now, that's also the thing that everyone does wrong in track is they go out too hard. So there's you can adjust. It's all hope is not lost if you find yourself going out too hard in a race. Like, oh, I got caught up in the excitement, or in this instance, even in a time trial, oh, I got caught up in the I want to hit a big goal and I'm going for it early. Check yourself as soon as possible. And so the rule of thumb is you have about 10 seconds of energy expenditure that does not negatively influence the rest of your energy capacity. And so this gets into the physiology. You asked the question, Addison, so you're getting the answers. We have three energy systems essentially that we use as runners. The obvious one is the aerobic energy system, and that requires oxygen and that produces low levels of byproduct. So that's very efficient. But the one that we're using when we're doing this level of effort, this high level effort, is more anaerobic. You really don't use that much oxygen at this point. It's still based on your aerobic capacity. So yes, you need that energy system to do this also. But point is, you're spending a fair bit of time mostly anaerobic and not as much aerobic. And so that requires less fuel, but creates a lot more byproduct. And so that's Andy's point. The longer you're running over this line, the worse you're going to feel sooner. And so there's a balance there. However, there's that third system, the third energy system, which is alactic anaerobic. And it burns a different source of fuel inside our cells. And you have about 10 seconds worth of that fuel. It's the creatine phosphate stuff that's going on. And so whenever you hear about people, you know, taking creatine supplements, there's a connection there. But anyway, point is, if you go out too fast, 5 to 10 seconds into the race, check yourself, reduce that a bit, calm down is the way that we say it in track, calm down and relax, and you'll be fine. You're not harming yourself by that accidental dead sprint off the start line, as long as you don't keep doing it. And so that's Andy's point. If you can stay relaxed for the initial stage, and I like Hodge's advice, 200 meters or so, just stay relaxed for the first 200. No one wins a race. No one runs a PR because of their first 200 meters.
And unless it's like a short distance race.
Well, I guess if it's a 200 meter race, you're going to. No one in a mile wins a race or runs a PR because of the first 200. So you want to settle in. You want to get comfortable and relax. And you don't want to be running already at the limit.
And part of it is rigidity in the body, too. It's not just an energy system thing. It's tense. Because the tension in the body. So it's good to at that, like after everyone's kind of settling, make sure you relax your shoulders. You find your arm carriage in the right position. You have a good torso lean. You want to be thinking about those things so that you're not running really rigid because that takes a lot of energy.
In other words, listen to what Hodge was about to say in the next section because that's the stuff he's talking about. So, okay, here's what we want to do now. Talk about the principles and then how you would execute this in a mile race. So the principles are, we're kind of getting into it a little bit already, but ultimately pacing for shorter races ideally is close to even. You really don't have a lot of potential if you're running at your very best possible mile potential. You don't have a lot of potential. Like I've said that word too many times. You don't have a lot of opportunity to run a massive negative split and like accelerate a ton in the later stages of the race. There's reasons for that, but in this short of a race, it's just not that likely. You can do some. And so a lot of people will say, okay, so you really want your fastest lap to be your last lap. That's good. But if your last lap is like the same as another lap and you have another lap that's just a touch faster, that's not a problem.
I do want to mention that running even means that that's not going to be even effort though. So when you run even splits, you're going to be you're going to be hurting way more in the end
than
even
beginning.
With the even split. So
we'll get into how you're going to feel.
How it feels. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, you know, just to differentiate between your pace, if you're pacing even, you're going to start at, I mean, it's obviously a short distance race, so it's going to be a good effort, but you're going to feel it much more in the
end.
We'll
get to that.
Okay.
In depth. But so if that's one of the principles, generally that's key, is your pacing should not, it shouldn't be dramatic in any direction. It should be fairly even across the race. Now, that being the case, you also could adopt the energy rule to produce an even split race, is what Andy's saying. The energy principle here does not mean your times reflect this. So what I'm about to say is not times, it's energy. And that is, in general, a nice rule of thumb is you want to have 50% of your available energy remaining for the last 25% of the race. And a mile's very nicely divided into quarters already for us. So you want to have half of the energy that's available to you still there when you start the last lap of the race. One, because you're going to have to expend a lot more energy to continue doing what you're doing. That's what Andy's saying. But also, that's what allows you to then finish in the fullest possible exertion when you have a little bit more energy than you need available. And so that's where you're going to get a little bit of acceleration in the last lap, potentially. As I say, many people do try to negative split in a race, in that instance, in the final lap, but it's not usually by much is in this kind of a distance. So if that's it, you could adopt that rule of thumb, and that's going to help. We'll explain that in a moment in terms of the specifics. And then ultimately, let me just provide a caveat. This is not necessarily the same advice we give for all distances, but for a mile, these are the things that we're saying. Okay, so here we go. As Andy was alluding to precisely, it doesn't feel the same each lap of the race, even if you're running in the same exact time in each lap of the race. So you have to accommodate that. You said to us that you were on pace for the first half and then things kind of started to fall apart. That means that you were running too hard in the first half and that your physiology probably is not ready at that moment to run that time. Now, that doesn't. There's many, many caveats we can apply. A time trial by yourself on a track, or even with teammates, but a time trial on a track is not the same thing as a race day experience. There's going to be a way different amount of energy and adrenaline, and that helps you when it comes to the race most of the time. And so we don't really compare apples to oranges here. We just simply address what we learn from a situation like that is likely we need to start a little bit easier, and we're not quite ready to run 5 minute or 5:10 yet necessarily. Doesn't mean you won't be next week or in 2 weeks, but in that instance, didn't seem like it. But here's how we find out. This is the way we would approach it. So, as Andy said, relax off the start line. You really don't want to be sprinting off the start at all. And that first lap should be close to what you hope to run in terms of pacing. If you're exerting energy appropriately, it should feel very comfortable. In a mile, you should not feel like you're working hard in the first lap. Any miler of any level, that should be true. First lap is comfortable. And if it's not, you got to back it off. You have to find that zone somewhere where you're running strong, but you're feeling great. Okay, second lap should actually feel about the same as the first lap. You're really not feeling like you're exerting too much yet. Still strong, still comfortable. Depending on the day, sometimes the second lap starts to hurt earlier than other times. But really, you're only halfway into the race. You should not be feeling strain in your exertion yet. As such, the second and first lap almost always should be very close together in pace if you're just running an even exertion, because your body is not fatigued enough yet where it's going to be feeling the effects and you're going to have to change energy exertionally. You're going to have to change your effort. So those should be fairly close together if you're running an even effort. So that's a good tell. How do I know if I was holding a consistent effort? Well, those paces should be close. Now, third and the fourth lap is when things change. The third lap in the mile is almost always the worst. Am I sharing an experience that you would agree with?
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, good. So if that's the case, what we mean by that is you start to feel it, but you can't slow down in principle, right? You don't want to slow down, but you're feeling worse. So now you have to increase your energy output to maintain the same pace. And in a mile, you should expect that. You should, in fact, plan to have to increase energy after the halfway point and increase effort, I should say, after the halfway point, but not see any improvement in pacing. And so in some instances, you even slow down a little bit while you feel like you're increasing effort still. If your time is dramatically slowing and you feel like you're running your guts out, that's how you know that you were running too fast, or rather giving too much effort in the first two laps. So that's another sign. Now, if that's the case and you can sustain it, you increase the effort a bit, but you're staying steady and the pacing ends up being fairly even still, maybe it's a touch slower, but it's still fairly even, that means that if you've done this right, that when you start the last lap, you have the ability to increase your effort further. You may not accelerate. You might not speed up. But at the start of the last lap, just like at the start of the third lap, you should have even more energy available to exert, because that's the only way you're going to hold pace, let alone accelerate a little bit, if that's the case. So you want to be able to say, when you start the last lap, I have more to give still. Not just more like I'm not completely empty, but I can actually increase my output. That's the way you gauge whether or not I have done this thing well in the first half. Can I increase effort? Do I have more to give in the last lap? Fundamentally, the goal would be that you feel like you have a lot of energy left to give at the start of the last lap and you can just really pour it on. You're probably not going to be there yet. Give it some time, some fitness building, some neuromuscular growth as you're going through the season, some experience just doing it more times.
I think it's also important to recognize that oftentimes when we're beginning as runners, exploring these uncomfortable races, that we have more to give than we think we do when we start feeling uncomfortable. So I think that's part of the exploration process, knowing like, okay, I have more to give. Well, maybe one day, or when you're starting off, you don't think you have more to give and you feel discouraged, you're feeling badly, you start looking at the ground, your form diminishes, and then you run slower than you actually could have. But it's a process of learning how to handle discomfort as well.
Right on. There's two choices you make in the last lap of a mile. One is finish strong, you know, give a good effort to maintain a good, strong race. Or if it's in a practice, whatever it is. And the second is give it all you got and drain the well. And we would suggest, Addison, that you do not do that in practice. Practice is not the time to empty everything you've got and see how fast you can run. It's nice to run fast in a training run, and it's exciting to see fast times, but you really shouldn't be doing that physiologically too often. It tends to delay recovery and then delay adaptations. And so you're not going to be able to improve quite as much over the course of the season if you're doing that too often. So save that for the races.
Which there'll be plenty of.
There will be enough of them. Mm-hmm. So don't worry about it. And you'll have plenty of time to rehearse that experience. So let's recap it for you here, Addison. You want to try to run the fastest race possible for a mile. That's your goal here. The best way to do that is to make sure that you have enough energy left that in the final lap, you can pour it on. You have more. In order to accomplish that, you need to be able to run strong but comfortable for the first half, feeling no strain. I'm feeling good. I'm not overexerting. That means that the third lap's probably going to feel difficult but totally manageable. And the fourth lap, you're able to give a little extra. If you can do that, just keep trying it. Practice that. Don't worry about what the watch says right now. Don't worry about what the clock says right now, because it's going to change as you get on in the season. You'll get much, much closer to your goals as all the pieces come together. Mm-hmm. Don't think about that too much at this point. And by the way, if you're running 5:28 in a time trial in March and you've got 2 months on the season and you're trying to run 5 to 5:10, you're going to do it. Just be patient and keep trying.
Awesome question, Addison, and good luck to you. Let's get on to our main topic. All On the show today, we have Coach Dave Hodgkinson, and this was an interview that we aired. It was just the second interview ever on the A to Z Running Podcast, and it was really popular.
Going way back.
Yeah, going way back, but we refer to this episode a lot, and we thought it'd be beneficial to bring it back because it was such an important and enlightening conversation for many people who have reached out to us about the show.
Yeah, and we were referencing it in our answer to Addison's question earlier because it just so happens to connect so closely. In principle, the idea that Hodge is going to put forth is that we can run faster without changing anything about exertion. Now, that's not the goal. The goal is not to not try harder also. But if you are doing things well in certain areas, it's helping you without any more effort. And so what does that mean? And what does that look like? Hodge is going to talk all about that. Reason why we feel like this, these kinds of topics are the kind of thing we need these reminders, because as runners, we hear it from you constantly as we're talking with each other and in our own experience, where it's like time goes by and suddenly I think, oh, you know, I haven't been doing that thing that I probably should be doing because I know it's helping me, but I get busy and I don't have a lot of time before or after my runs, and then I forget and now I'm not really doing it anymore. Well, here's your reminder with the very best of them, Coach Hodge. So we're talking about running economy today, and certainly an area that you have a vast amount of experience and expertise. If you could just give us a bit of your background and why this topic is so close to home for you.
So I was a high school athlete who ran about 17 minutes when I was a senior. So I was fairly mediocre. So after I got out of high school, I went to college, hurt myself immediately, and moved back home and decided I was going to be a coach, and somehow got interested in how do you move better. Happened mostly because of the 1984 Olympics, when I saw these steeplechasers from Kenya go 1, 2, 3 and go, and I thought, how is that possible? How are they doing that? Watched that video maybe 50, 60 times to figure out what they were doing, and finally noticed that they're just moving their legs a little bit different when they suddenly pop off everybody else with a lap and a half to go, and they just run away from everybody. So that was the initial impetus for me to start studying this. I learned from some people in Canada all the drills and things that they do in Canada to teach people how to run well. It's mostly Canadian is a club system, so it's the Canadian clubs, and one of the clubs just south of Toronto, there was a guy who worked there who taught me some of this stuff at some clinics. And then I was at a school in Caledonia, and they sent me to Portland to learn some stuff too. And so I went out to Portland, and I was the speed and strength teacher at Caledonia, and mostly got that stuff from those two places. But this has also kind of become my hobby. So this is what I do in my spare time. I look for new ways to talk about how to move more efficiently and more effectively.
And it is telling that not only is it something, you know, that in your past, but something you just enjoy, you said, as a hobby. That's profound, because you feel that there's value in it, but also, you know, you pursue it passionately. So we can trust that the experiences that you have are constantly being informed by new learning, and, you know, you bring a lot to that topic.
That's the fun of it for me, is learning the new stuff and trying it with a kid or an adult and seeing them improve tremendously. That's where I kind of get my kicks from. So
The topic of running economy, referring to, as you were kind of articulating, like how we move and how we do so with efficiency and those kinds of things. That's the big umbrella. In your work, what are the most important influences on those kinds of things, on running economy and its associated facets?
Our biggest problem we have when we become inefficient is that we're overstriding. So when your center of gravity is behind where your foot strike is, you're going to tend to have a stop-start motion on every step. And if we can minimize that, you're never going to get rid of it completely, because then you never load onto the leg. So we want a little bit of loading, but if we can minimize it at least, then we can become more efficient. We run faster without trying harder, which is a beautiful thing in my world.
I like that. Run faster without trying harder. So all of our listeners just perked up and said, hey, I would love to do that.
In fact, that's something that you've said to me, because as I mentioned in the introduction, Hodge was my coach, and he would ask me the question, do you want to feel better? And the answer is always yes, right? Have you ever had anyone say no to you?
No, but I've had people not do it because for some reason they just couldn't pull themselves into it. But they all want to feel better.
Absolutely.
So overstriding being very prominent. Anything else then?
When we overstride, that tends to cause most of the problems. And if we can fix that through various methods, most of the problems fix themselves. So the other things that we have a tendency to do wrong is we just have weaknesses, right? So if we have a weakness in our glutes and our feet turn out, and for instance, you're a little duck-footed, you tend to have some shin problems, you tend to have foot problems. So we have issues like that, but those are more personal issues that we work. The general gist of this is if we can keep the overstride down and we can keep the cadence up, you can run way more effectively and you will feel tremendously different and lighter and quicker on your feet, which is what I keep telling people. When you get to the 2 mile and a 5K, you want to feel light and quick, and things have gone really well at that point.
So what do you do to try to improve these?
So the first thing we always work on is our posture. Okay, so the very first thing we want to do is make sure that we have all of our joints in a straight line. So the top of the head, the shoulders, the hips, the knees, and the feet have to be in a straight line. When we get out of a straight line, then it encourages us to overstride because we're not standing tall and the center of gravity has dropped. So if all of those can be in a straight line and we can have some drills to make that happen, then you have much less chance of overstriding when you start to run. So first thing we do with everybody is we just have them put their hands on the top of their head, stand up tall. That's how we should feel when we run. Most of us, when we start to run, are shorter when we're running than when we're walking. Typically, we should be taller when we're running because we're propelling ourselves off the ground. So we would think if we want to be effective, we want to be taller when we hit the ground, and when we stay on that ground, we propel ourselves. So if we can learn to do that, so we keep the head up tall. The next thing coming down the body is the eyes. If your eyes are looking down, your body follows your eyes. So when the eyes drop down, the hips drop back, and we're out of that straight line motion again. So those are the big things you can work on first. You get the top of the head really tall, the eyes stay up. Okay, and then as you do this, and that's a process to get your eyes up. That's not something you're going to say, hey, I'm going to keep my eyes up today, because they will immediately go down the minute you forget what you're doing. So that is a habit we have to break over time. In a race, it's beautiful. There's always somebody right there. It's the training part that's hard, right? And then in a race, we tend to get into our own heads. And as soon as you get in your own head, the eyes drop down. If you watch an elite race, you can probably see there'll be a pack of guys, pack of girls. Somebody will put their eyes down. 7 or 8 steps later, they're out the back of the pack. So their hips drop back, they overstride, they can't keep the cadence anymore, and they drop out the back of the pack.
When you're watching races, especially at like that elite or Olympic level or those kinds of things, are you looking at that stuff? Like, you're watching for that kind of stuff?
Again, that's my hobby. So that's what I watch the whole time.
I love it.
So if there were like bets on races, like there are in horses, you would dominate.
No, you have to bet before it starts.
Yeah, you can't bet.
That's true.
Yes, you can't bet with a half a lap to go.
That's true. Okay.
Good thing that Andy isn't into sports gambling.
Yes, I'm not. Unfortunately, well, there is Donovan Brazier. I can tell whether he's going to win the race when he starts the first 10 or 12 steps. He moves differently when he's dominant than he does when he's not. And obviously this last year, he was dominant all the time, right? But he's had some times in the past where he would not move well, his foot didn't come up well in back, and then he would not be able to kick at the end. And because of it, because he was inefficient, he couldn't find that second or third gear he had in the last bit of the race, which he has now every single time.
Seems like it, yeah.
Yeah.
So certainly, you know, as you look, it's kind of like you have this top down kind of element in that sense. When people are implementing some of those factors well, but things are still not there. Where do you look next?
So I usually just work from the bottom up or the top down on individuals when I work with an individual. So if we continue the way down the body, we got the head tall, we got the eyes, then the sternum needs to stay upright. Because most of us, when we start to get tired, we'll let that come forward. And when it comes forward, when we come forward at the top, something has to compensate. And what it compensates is our hips go out the back. So when our hips go out the back, we tend to start to overstride again. The feet get a little heavy. And then we say, now I feel bad. I don't know why I feel bad. We do know why you feel bad. You feel bad because your feet are hitting in front of you. It's costing you more energy on every step to get off that foot again.
Is there risk? And so I should give context to this question, because as you're saying that, I'm just reflecting on a very recent experience where, I was feeling bad pretty consistently, and I got on a treadmill and put a camera on myself, you know, just put my phone somewhere nearby so I could see it, and then would run for a few minutes and go and watch it. And because I knew something was just not. And as it turns out, yeah, a lot of things were off. As I was working to correct some of them, I started to feel some back pains. And some other things that just like, you know, pains that weren't good and that were starting to worsen over some of that. But I was also just kind of trying to do it on my own. So all of this is coming to the question of how do you do these kinds of changes in a way that maximizes that without risking other potential problems?
So like any change you put in your training, it's going to have to be gradual, right? We don't jack our mileage up really fast, right? We don't just decide I'm going to sprint every day. Right, every change has to be gradual. So what I like to do is work at the posture things first. And if we can get the postural things down, then the muscles will have time to adapt. And then you can start working on the things that will kick a little more speed into you by changing the way you're actually moving instead of just changing the way you're standing. So the postural things are what I tend to work on first. And then as I'm doing that, we will work on some strength exercises to build up some muscles that are obviously having problems with specific individuals.
I think I kind of led us to this by accident at the moment, but so there's certainly a school of thought out there, and now you know where I'm heading with this, that says we're all different, we're all unique, structurally, physiologically, biologically. And that being the case, the best thing is to let whatever is natural be so that I feel the most natural or whatever comes naturally to me.
See, I would totally agree that we're all different and we're all unique, but I would also assume that you all totally agree there are laws of physics that we cannot violate without having some effects on our body. And so while I'm looking for specific things, I'm not trying to create clones, right? So some people have longer legs. They're going to move differently than people with shorter legs. So depending on who the person is, we're just trying not to have them violate those laws of physics. And when you overstride, we have a law of momentum that when you hit in front of yourself, that law of momentum says we're slowing that momentum down if the stride is too far out in front of us. So regardless of who you are, the farther you get out front, if you hit that with force, you're going to have some problems there.
Speaking of problems, because I've had injuries, how important is running economy to staying healthy?
I think it's one of the most important things. Most typically, I can watch the way someone's running and tell you where their problem is coming from. If you hit on, let's go back to that overstride with your foot turned out a little bit. When you do that and you roll across the arch collapses every time, which tends to mean you're going to get shin splints. So when kids start, they all tend to move like that. They get tired, the feet fly out because their glutes are weak, and they start to run, and everybody gets shin splints the first 2 weeks of middle school cross country practice. And then what we have to realize is if we can get those glutes to work right and we can get them loose and they can be strong, that all those problems tend to go away. So I did middle school cross country this year. Kind of fun. Interesting to start kids. Yes. And not one person on the problem and the team had shin splints this year.
That's a major accomplishment. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, we should probably clap.
For yeah.
Yeah, and that's so important because it seems so easy, and I'm speaking now from the coach's perspective. When I was coaching high school for the first time, it's so easy to hear the complaints and the problems and just be like, yeah, you're weak, you're undertrained, you know, you haven't really done this before, you're new to the sport, just give it time and it'll just kind of work itself out. But without intent, you may even potentially be causing more problems, it would seem, than...
Yeah, and I think my philosophy has shifted over the years because I've dealt with middle school kids and I've dealt with elite people. So my philosophy has gone more to how can I make you better from where you're at? Which means if you're having shin splints, we got to fix those first so that you can continue to train more, right? And we can start to build those, you know, build the mileage up, build the speed up. You can move more effectively and we can do some things. If you're hurt, none of that's going to happen. So, you know, because I think I've had the luxury of having really good athletes before, I don't feel like I have to make every one of them really good right now. Mm-hmm. And I can be patient with them. And so that's what I would encourage anyone to do if they're changing their form. It's a process you have to do. When I learned this stuff, it took me about a year to learn how to do it well. And that was without any kind of hiccups in that time. So I changed things a little bit at a time. And I went from 1708 to 1530 in that year.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think anyone would want to see that kind of improvement.
Yeah, if we put a percentage point on that, that's exceptional.
Yeah. So the research that I can find says if you can get a 1% increase in your efficiency, which sounds like nothing, but it's actually going to take you a long, long time to do, you can get up to 10% improvement in your time. I personally have never seen anyone get 10%, but I've seen people get darn close. You know, 20-minute girls run 18:15. If they work at this stuff and move differently. There are a couple kids that I worked with over the summer who were seventh and eighth people on their team, and the next year they went in, they were the first runner. So just by fixing their form and fixing their efficiency. The nice thing is when you get more efficient, there's less pounding on your body, which means now I can do a little more, now I can do it a little faster, and now the training effect starts to get in there too. And so you're not just learning to move differently, it also opens the doors to doing things better and doing things harder.
So a scenario, I'm curious then, because you going back to, you mentioned, you know, a full year in that one instance to really kind of get to that point. And certainly it would take time, even if it's not a full year for anyone. Let's say I've got 6 weeks before a major race. I'm running a marathon in 6 weeks. I'm going for my Boston qualifier or PR. And I'm feeling some of those things, or I'm listening to this podcast and I'm like, I've never thought of these things before. So I got to fix it right now. Do I do that? Do I do only certain things? What would you tell me?
Tremendously bad idea to try and fix it all right now. So you should fix one thing at a time. So if you're trying to get that Boston qualifier time, and this is just going to be the thing that you maybe kicks you over the edge, maybe it's just keeping your eyes up. Right? Maybe it's just, I'm going to find someone to stare at the back of their hat the whole stupid race, and they're going to drag me through to that time. Or you stare at the sign with the little time on it, right? Your eyes are up then, right?
If you're close enough to the sign that you can see it, right?
Yes. Yes. So you've got a bunch of things you can do there. So that I would try to do one thing at a time. When I did this, I added one thing at a time in. And when I coach athletes, I usually give them one specific thing to focus on at each point. And once they master that, then we move on to the next ones.
Is some of that the teacher in you talking to?
Absolutely. Yes.
Isn't that it though? If we want to do this right, we need to do each part of it right.
Absolutely.
I love that. So I'm curious, kind of taking this outside of the immediate context of training and just our everyday lives and all of the things, the activities we find ourselves in, or even just sitting at the dinner table and how we sleep and, you know, all of these kinds of factors can influence this kind of stuff. What are the things that we should be more aware of and trying to avoid so that we're not counterproductive to the good work we're doing in training?
Yeah, I think one of the things we can do, we all tend to live our lives in our own heads, which means most of the time your eyes are down. And it's very interesting to put your eyes up. I learned this personally. We were hiking in Colorado through the snow, and we had a young man in the back who could not keep up no matter what. We were constantly trying to get him to keep up, and he's always looking at the trail, trudging along. So the guide, who now I consider to be my personal teacher, says, "Get up here in the front. Show us where we're going." the kid looks up, he's got to follow the trail, and now he's charging all the time. We can't keep up with him. Yeah. So a lot of that taught me a ton about just how we live. And a lot of times when we live all focused down and in, we tend to, that personality trait or that physical turns into a physical manifestation, right? So if we can just think out, you know, out and out, think about what's going on instead of thinking about just what's that voice in my head that's constantly spinning, that would be one big thing. And we do that all the time, right? When we sit in the car, we have a tendency to just focus right here instead of sitting up tall and focusing out, right? So all those little things you can do will build the strength that it takes to do, you know, to make you a better runner while you're out there on the road.
I really needed to hear you say that about keeping your eyes up in daily life, because I'm someone who's sitting on my phone looking down, and even just being hunched down in my social media. I think a lot of people, I don't think I'm the only one who struggles with that, but I totally get what you're saying, because my attitude even is not as good as if I'm active during the day, like doing cleaning or keeping my eyes up, going outside. So I can really take that with me, and that will be really great just in my daily life.
We work at in the summer, I work at a camp, and one of the things we do there is we take the kids' phones away.
Yes.
Awesome.
So they don't have a phone for 7 straight days, and the difference in those kids from the time they get there to the time they leave is incredible. And a lot of that, I believe, has to do with the fact that they are not staring at their phone constantly. So they are engaged. They are paying attention. They are moving better. They are having more fun interacting with other people. It's amazing what happens when we take that little crutch away from them.
Hod, you're hurting me a little bit here, because I am a willful and joyful introvert and very much appreciate the world inside my head and often don't appreciate the world outside my head. This is an extreme example, obviously, but you know, that's just it. It might feel uncomfortable and awkward. I'm just thinking about this. You know, it might feel uncomfortable and awkward, but there's more than just training value to this too. Like, to be aware of the world around me, and especially the people around me, then as a consequence, that's good advice.
Well, and the interesting thing about this is we all know what a depressed person looks like. Right, you see someone, you can pick them out. If I asked you to stand like a depressed person, you would hunch your shoulders over, you would put your head down, right? You'd roll your shoulders in, right? The exact opposite of what we were just talking about. So it's a feedback loop, right? So when you stand like that because you feel bad, it makes you feel worse. And it's just a feedback loop. There's an opposite feedback loop too. Right. So if we can get tall, we can stand up, we can keep our eyes up and get into that good posture in a nice straight line. Then all of a sudden the upward feedback loop comes. I feel better all the time. What we tend to do in a race, though, the minute something goes wrong is, oh, no. And we collapse. Right. And so if we can learn not to do that by focusing out. And I agree with your introvert, which some people would be surprised. I'm extroverted when I need to be. So, yes. But but that feedback loop going the other way is the key to being successful, because you're not going to have a race or a run where everything goes right the whole time. And it's the overcoming that and sticking with what we need to do, which will continue to lead us into feeling better and running faster.
I definitely appreciate that. And there's a clear connection to the conversation so many of us have just about like goals and expectations, especially in performance. And you know that if you have only one goal, and especially if that's a challenging goal, and you're not reaching it or you're not on pace to reach it in a performance, that's immediately disheartening, discouraging, right? And so then we see that pattern of, you know, the physical ramification of that discouragement as well. But even just then, the idea of, if you can have a kind of a tier of goals, and especially if you can salvage a performance, how much more effectively can you do that when you're mindful of those kinds of things? So the physical part doesn't start to collapse just as severely as that emotional part would.
Andy and I have probably talked hundreds of times about this exact thing. I believe in process goals. Outcome goals are awesome, but outcome goals aren't where we get our kicks. Our kicks should come from that process goals. And that process goal, when I talk with kids, I have these like Jenga blocks that I stack up and we try to knock them over but you just build the process goals down, and you can take one little block and you can blow on it. And if that block is, I tell students most of the time, that block is, how can I get better right now? Regardless of what's going on, regardless of how I feel, or if it's awesome or horrible, what am I doing to get better right now? You can just blow on that block and all the big ones start to fall. And so that's what I try to do with the form stuff, right? So I can specifically remember at Carson City where Andy was at in the middle of the race, in the 30s maybe, in the race, and I said, Andy, just get your feet out of the grass, and boom, she did it. Goes from 30 to 4th at the end of the race. Wow. Had an incredible second half of the race and got done and went, the second half felt so much better than the first half.
And you're like, of course.
Yeah.
Right? You know, one of the things that just makes me think about is how often we hear coaches, and I love this. I love being at races, just listening to the coaches. What are they yelling at the athletes and what are they saying before or after, but especially during. And, you know, we know that it's not a new thing to try to be aware of these kinds of factors. I think there's a lot of ideas out there and not a lot of like clear plans. And so it's really helpful as you're articulating that, Hodge, to really see kind of a clear plan of intent to make the best possible changes. But I'm just reflecting a moment on sometimes I hear coaches saying things and I don't quite understand what they're trying to accomplish by yelling that at an athlete.
Like, hustle.
Well, there's, you know, that can be positive, I guess, in some instances. But I want to give an example. And then I'm curious if you have any, Hodge, if you have any that you've heard that you're like, what on earth are you trying to say there? So here's the example that we always laugh about here. We're at a track meet, and I don't remember. It was a national championship in college somewhere, you know, right? So high-level stuff. And this coach is yelling at one of the distance runners every time, every lap. He yells, forearm angles. I'm quoting directly. Forearm angles. Forearm angles. First of all, I'm not sure what angles you have in your forearm. Secondly, what is he trying to accomplish with your forearm angles?
I'm guessing he's telling the athlete that his hand is too close to his shoulders and that the head to drop.
Ah.
Drop your hands would probably be a little easier to say, and maybe that kid would understand it so you didn't have to say it every time. So, but there's a little something to that, but as we were talking earlier, there are individual differences because we're all built different. So when I was running my 17 minutes, my hands were right up there on my shoulders, right? And I learned to drop them. Generally, when my center of gravity came up higher, the hands went down by themselves, right? So I think sometimes we worry about things that look bad, that don't really, they're not caused by what we think they are. Like no one's hands are on their shoulders because, oh, that's the way I like them. Mm-hmm. They're there because something else is causing them to be there, mm-hmm. right? And mine was because my center of gravity was too low. I was overstriding and my hands had to go somewhere. So they just came across my body because if I swung them straight over here, my hand would have been over my head and I would have looked like an idiot. So nobody wants to do that. So we compensate. So we pull them across instead. So when you figure out what's actually causing the issue, it's way easier to fix rather than just insisting that the athlete puts their hands down. I'm guessing if they could, they would have done it a long time ago. One of my one of the reasons I became a coach when I was in high school, the team that we were always trying to beat had a coach who would go off onto the back of the course, smoke a cigarette, and swear at his athletes as they went by that they weren't trying hard enough. And I thought, I can do better than that.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm going to do because I know I can do that.
Yeah. And that's, you know, and that becoming something, you know, you've impacted so many athletes and programs, you know, both the programs you've coached and just the ones you've supported instill significant impacts. And so as I'm just kind of reflecting on, you know, that process for you, that's been profound, and we can certainly appreciate, you know, Andy benefiting directly from time working with you and so many others too. So thank you for making that choice and for entering the field with such passion.
This is who I'm supposed to be, in my opinion. I feel like I've been led to certain places to deal with specific individuals, and I can point to them at every one of the places I've been. And And I think this is just who I was made to be. And so I've accepted that and don't try to be someone else.
So. Well, we appreciate who you are. And there was something that I was thinking of when we were talking about keeping eyes up. And I remember a time, well, many times that was part of the conversation that we had. And then a specific time that we were at the track and you just said, just run over there. And he's like, run like that. Run like you're going somewhere. Because, and I've actually taken that with me. I think that in my head when things are tough all the time, because I think as athletes, when we're in pain, sometimes we think like we're in this twilight zone where the moment never ends. And whenever I think, no, I'm going somewhere and I have my posture is better. Like I start running with better running economy. And I distinctly remember that when you had me just run across the field and you're like, yeah, run like that.
When you do that, you're running with purpose instead of just to get it done. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times we run just to get it done. When you're a little kid and you're running to get a ball, watch them. It's beautiful, right? There's no thinking. They just go, right? And when we think that way, when we're thinking, I'm just going to get to that point, right? And then you can play with speed, you can play with things, and then it becomes more of a game like the kids, and you enjoy it so much more than if you say, you know, I'm going to march down here with my head up tall and my eyes straight up and not enjoy this. No, you got to have some fun with it. The whole purpose, in my opinion, of this, the whole purpose is A, to test ourselves, right? We want to see what we can become and how we can get better. And, you know, and that helps us in all areas of our lives, right? And B, to have a good time. I'm hoping nobody runs because it's your chore, right? Yes. So I think we all have some kind of enjoyment from this.
So that's really the great summarizing statement. I think we just can draw that out one more time, which is, you know, how does it begin when you first talk to an athlete, you know, and why should you do these things? And so, Hodge, if you could just say that for us one more time then, why do you tell athletes to do these things?
So when I start with, when somebody's starting to run, my big thing is, how can we get better as people, right? We just want to make ourselves better. And I have my purpose statement for cross country every time I coach is, how do we get better physically? How do we get emotionally? How do we get better spiritually? How do we get better in every single way of our life? And we include academic in that when I'm dealing with students. And so if we can improve in those areas all the time, then things turn out to be really good. And when you're improving, it's fun. Right. So if we can take care of these little tiny things, like just standing a little taller, then it makes the enjoyment better. Right. You feel better while you're getting it done. You feel better when you're going faster. And so those are the things we work on.
Well, thank you so much for being here. It means a lot to us, not only because we have connection to you, but also because you're obviously a high expert in this area. So thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We always like to start the World of Running segment with some shout outs to A to Z runners. Last week, Laura ran the Las Vegas Rock and Roll Half Marathon.
Right on. Jacob ran Atlanta Half Marathon as well.
And then Kate and Craig both ran Little Rock Marathon.
And saw each other there unintentionally. Well, not unintentionally.
Well, they've
they
never met.
Know that they yeah, were yeah. going to see each other there. They have not met, which is, you know, the product of, we support runners from all over the place, multiple continents, and certainly many states in the United States. And so these people don't necessarily know each other, but they show up at an event and they're wearing similar shirts. Yeah, shout out to the A to Z runners.
Yeah.
And that's really fun. Now, a quick note about Craig. I got to boast on Craig for a minute if I can.
And then I'll boast on Kate.
Yes.
So you go first.
Yep.
Okay.
So anecdotally, Craig had some alternative goals for this race. This is not like a focus race for him. He's trying to run marathons all over the 50 states of the U.S. And he's well on his way, by the way. If anyone's keeping track, this dude is going to do it. But point being, this was one of those where he's kind of like checking off a box. But at the same time, every time Craig does a marathon, we talk about, what do we want to get out of this one in particular? What's the point of this? What's the kind of thing that you want to achieve within this event? Even if it's not a focal point, even if it's, because in many of these, Craig's just out there running easy. He's not trying to push himself for a time. He's not trying to push himself for a performance. And this one in particular, Craig had an idea and I really liked it. And so he decided to go for it. He was going to change up some of the strategizing we were doing to create a context in which he should negative split the race without necessarily doing deliberately like changing effort and trying to finish hard or anything. And just wanting to feel good in the last 10K and enjoy the final stages of the race. You know, in a marathon, even if you're running well easier than you could, it's still 26 miles. And that doesn't always mean those last six are lovely. Well, not only did Craig execute very well and had a really positive experience, minus having to jump over someone who tripped right in front of him. That kind of threw him off a little bit. But aside from that, Craig said, he's like, I think I might have passed like 100 people in the last few miles of this race.
Wow.
And it was just really fun and excited to just kind of have like a positive momentum in the late stages of a marathon, which is just rare and difficult to achieve. So congrats, Craig, on that. Exciting. Glad to be supporting you through it and looking forward to the next one.
Yeah, and Kate ran with a friend, so this was not her goal race either, but she ended up negative splitting as well and had a great run, especially for not being the goal race. But she ran with a friend, and she has great fitness, so she had fun, which was the goal, and also was running pretty speedy.
So good. Congrats to everyone running the stuff and enjoying the things. Mm-hmm. Speaking of, let's talk about the world championships.
Yeah, let's start with the 3,000, which was thrilling.
So in the indoor track and field championships, just for clear context here, two things distinctly different about indoors versus outdoors. One is the arena. So indoors is an inside track that is half the distance of the outdoor track. So outdoor track is 400 meters. It's a big oval. Fits around a football field, things like that, right? Indoor tracks are 200-meter tracks traditionally. There are many other distances of these tracks, but in competition, they're going to be 200-meter tracks. And they have banked curves because it's such a tight curve that, especially for the sprinters, you can't make that curve on a flat. It just isn't possible, or you break your ankles if you do. And so they've got banked curves. They do the sprinting events in the middle of the track, not on the side straightaways, because they need more space for them to finish and not run into the wall. And they still do that, by the way. They run into the wall. There's a huge pad, they call it the crash pad, that they run through the finish line and then up the banked curve into the crash pad. And I have to tell you, it's a terrible idea because runners get hurt regularly.
Oh,
not
no.
Badly, but they like bash their ankle in a weird way. They're finishing a 60 meter all-out sprint, right? So they're only just getting up to top speed, if that, when they cross the finish line. And then suddenly they start running up a slope because they're on a banked curve and into a padded wall. Just bam, and they hit it hard. You can see it. So that's terrible. Track organizers, change that. Stop it. Okay, that's it. That's all I'm going to say
about
it.
That's all you're going to say, okay.
But the other thing that's different is because of the nature of that condition, that constraint, they do different events in indoor track. They don't do all of the long events. They do some different in field events, and it's just not exactly the same track meet. So there's some excitement around, you know, something that's different and unique and all that kind of stuff.
And the longest of them for the world championships for this year is the 3,000-meter run.
Yeah.
Yes.
What a fun event.
Mm-hmm. And you get a variety of different runners in this event. They come down from longer distances and up from shorter distances. So sometimes you have mashups that aren't typical.
Yeah.
And I love that.
Yeah. It's really exciting.
On the women's side, we're going to talk through the 3,000-meter championship run. Beatrice Chepkoech took it out hard, and now she's a 3,000-meter
steeplechase. She's the world record holder in the steeplechase.
And when I say she took it out hard, she took it out like really hard. 65 for her first 400.
That would be seconds. 65 seconds.
65 seconds.
You're going to have to give us more context. How do we know that that's really hard?
So Addison, for instance, for a mile, that's going to be a 420 mile.
So for further context, that would be about the pace that the women ran in the 1,500 meter.
That's insane.
Which is half the distance. So she went out fast.
Oh, it's crazy.
Wow.
Then it slowed at 1K, and then Gudaf Sege took the lead to try to keep the pace hot, to keep it honest.
World record holder for the 5,000 outdoors.
Right. And then
does she still hold an indoor world record too?
No, I don't think anymore. She has the she won the 10,000 in 2023 and the 5,000 in 2022 outdoors.
Yeah. So already we've got a clash of titans who don't generally race each other because they're different specialties. That's exciting.
Right. And then, so it's just very interesting how this all goes down.
Keep going.
So the rest of it, I'm not going to like talk through like how the rest played out like on the track, except for that the end. Gudaf Sege was out sprinted by USA's very own Ellie St. Pierre.
For the gold medal. What?
Yes.
First ever gold for an American in the event.
Yes. Yep. St. Pierre was fourth through the entire race until the 1K mark. And then
she ran like a pro. Well, she is a pro. I mean, they're all pros. But she did it just perfectly.
Mm-hmm. She moved into third just before the bell and then moved into second on the backstretch. And then for the final 200, she ripped it. And she ran the final 100 in 14.69.
That's pretty fast.
That's really fast.
14 and change for a 100-meter sprint.
And what I love about Ellie St. Pierre, you know I have it in my heart for all these mama runners. She gave birth not even a year ago. So it's going to be a year in March, but like it hadn't been quite a year yet.
Yeah.
When she got her first gold.
So we have talked about, we suspect that there's actually more to it on multiple levels. Like giving birth does change people, but it makes super people. I'm quite convinced.
I don't know. So my personal experience is that I got faster after having my boys, like a lot faster.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Like right away and kind of unexplained and inexplicably.
Obviously my blood volume was higher, but after a while, that's not a factor. So anyway,
your ability to suffer. I don't know. Who knows?
Maybe,
but anyway.
Maybe it's pain tolerance.
How fast was this, Andy?
Okay,
the time was
so fast. 8:20.87.
Which doesn't mean a ton for us. You know, 3,000 meters. It's under 9-minute pace for 2 miles.
That tells you.
So under 4:30 per mile.
Championship record. So that means the fastest for the world championships indoors ever. It's the American record. And number 3 on the all-time world indoor
list.
There you go. Yeah. And as Zach said, it was the first ever gold medal in the women's 3,000 for an American.
Yeah.
Now, Sege got her silver in 8:21, and she was disappointed. Her season's best was 8:17.11, which was just shy of the world record this season.
2 years in a row, Gudaf Sege, we mentioned this earlier in the year, she has missed the world record in this event by tenths of a second, 2 years in a row.
Yeah.
And in this particular instance, also then missed the gold.
It was just weird tactically. It went out really fast and it slowed down and then Sege was leading. You know, there's all kinds of championship
strategies. No one knows what to do in a 3,000.
Yeah. It wasn't like in a world record attempt, there's lights and pacers and all that jazz, which championship races aren't usually as fast as races that are supposed to be attempts. But of course, Ellie St. Pierre ran her lifetime best and the American best. So that was really impressive by her. And then Beatrice Chepkoech, whom I mentioned, the steeplechaser, got the bronze and a Kenyan record.
All right.
8:22.68. And Jessica Hall was fourth place in an Australian record. Actually, I think it might have been the whole area, Oceania record of 8:24.39.
Which is, if I recall, tenths faster than what she ran in the head-to-head duel against St. Pierre earlier this season.
Okay.
Where she outkicked St. Pierre. No, it was before that.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was kind of crazy. These women were brutal.
If I were to say like that was the event for the women's distance running, like it had the most amount of talent.
Oh yeah, it was stacked to the brim.
Yeah. So on the men's side, profoundly absent was Jakob Ingebrigtsen.
Yeah, not surprising. He had said all along he wasn't really going to do indoor this year. But it was still stacked on the men's side, just like on the women's side. And as Andy mentioned earlier, you get the clashing of people from different events. And so you have some specialists here in this particular one. That's just, it's uncommon. But Gednet Wale, Lemecha Girma, like guys like that run 3,000 meters a lot. And so Gednet Wale is in the race. He's a 5,000 meter specialist that spends a lot of time at the 3,000 distance. And then you've got Salomon Berrega, who is an Olympic champion in the 10,000, but also, you know, a lot of the 5,000 type of range distances. But then you've got Josh Kerr, who's the world champion in the 1500 from last year. You've got Alan Hacker, similarly coming from shorter distances. And then, of course, Yared Nuguse, who is basically a miler. I mean, he does other things, but he really doesn't do other things. And so all of these guys coming from all these different places, how's it going to shake up? And I'm missing someone else I wanted to mention too, but I didn't see him on here. Anyway, okay, so that's exciting.
Yeah.
Because you don't know what to expect, except that there was a clear momentum. Because if you recall, Josh Kerr just broke the indoor 2-mile record like a couple weeks ago.
Wasn't that the one that Jakob Ingebrigtsen got last year?
Got outdoor last year.
Oh.
So they both hold those records still.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yes. But Yared Nuguse was in that race with Kerr. And so it was kind of like a nice preview of the two of them at least. And Kerr just like smashed all over that record and certainly won that race. So how is it going to fare? How's it going to fare this time around? Well, Gednet Wale doing the early work from Ethiopia. And he's not unfamiliar with running fast paces, going out hard, leading races, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So he's comfortable doing the early work. But Josh Kerr just was like, you could tell. It's just like in the 1500 last summer. Like, you know from the very beginning that he wanted blood.
Yeah, he's hunting. Looks like he's hunting.
Fiercely. So we should add a layer here. Josh Kerr is a Scot, and this event was in Glasgow, Scotland. So he's got home crowd. When they announced him at the beginning, the crowd went crazy, roaring. And it's like, how are you going to beat this guy? He is a titan among boys in this particular instance. And so, yeah, Josh Kerr chomping at the bit right there. But it was actually Salomon Berrega who made the late surge, and that's dangerous. Berrega's got he's got the capacity, especially in a race like this, to throw down a constant acceleration. He's done it many times in races where he starts moving, and it's not like some crazy move, but it just keeps getting faster and faster and faster, and it just wears people off. Well, he wasn't wearing these guys off. They all stuck pretty close. Alan Hacker, in fact, was the one then who took the lead after the bell. And so that's, by the way, in this particular instance, as I mentioned, the bell means they only have 200 meters to go. On an outdoor track, that's half a lap. So we're talking
200 meters to go, yeah.
They're at dead sprints just right. About already.
And he's from the U.S., by the way, yes. For those of you who aren't familiar with him yet. But he was second at the U.S. champs.
Yep. So Hacker makes a move, and it's like, all right, go Hacker. He was not one that anyone would expect to win this race on account of the fact that you have the likes of Josh Kerr and Yared Nuguse in the race that people were just figuring were likely to win it. But anyway, he's making moves. Berrega's making moves. And then Josh Kerr makes a move, and it was over.
Yeah.
As soon as he decided, I'm going to win, he won.
Yeah.
And to his credit, Yared Nuguse had an excellent finish, amazing finish, but he didn't have the position quite as well as he ought to have with 200 meters to go, which is his curse. Nuguse, you got to race better, man. You are faster than everyone else in the world almost all the time, but they beat you by tactics. And in this particular case, Kerr was in a better
position. It really is tough. These tiny tracks. It's tough.
Yeah.
So Nuguse was fifth at the bell. So he had
a lot of work to do.
A lot of moving to do.
He moved all of it. Except for
he moved
Kerr.
Up really well. He was really close, actually, to the closing time of Kerr. So, but he wasn't quite close enough. So Kerr, for instance, he ran a 25.19 final 200, and Nuguse ran a 25.24.
That is so fast.
Yeah. So Nagus ended up outleaning Brega for silver.
Yep.
Yep.
So Josh Kerr wins with the home crowd. Just crowds roaring. So exciting. And Yared Nagus takes home his first global medal, which should be the first among many because this dude is talented.
Seriously.
Yeah, he took a silver. And then Salomon Barega, Ethiopia, not unfamiliar with the medal stand, and he ended up third. And then, by the way, Gednet Wally, close fourth, and Alan Hacker from the U.S., to his credit, running strong, finishes fifth in a global championship. Good things.
Now, the next couple races, we're not going to go in quite as much detail, but...
that was just really, really
that
exciting.
That was really exciting. Those 3,000s were stacked. They were awesome. So in the men's 800, as always, there was just so much aggression. It was so physical in that first 200.
Can I talk about the men's 800?
Yeah.
Okay, so this one in particular, So the 800 is like they care so much about where they are in the beginning of the race that they will fight each other. And you get a bit of like people are like pushing and shoving and elbowing and it was nasty. But... Wait, now was this the one when the guy got pushed off the track? I thought that was this one. Maybe it was the 1500. But either way, someone actually got pushed off the track in one of the events.
Well, I think they said that he didn't actually step onto the inside of the field, so he wasn't.
No. Someone actually got pushed off the track.
Track. It wasn't this one.
Fell down and like didn't finish the race. Okay, well, no. So in this particular instance, though, men's 800, you've got six guys in the race, and it was quick. They were definitely going for it. So now you've got defending champ Mario Garcia of Spain. And
took the lead in the first 400.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yep, taking the lead. And so 400, two laps in. They've got two laps to go. You've got Crestan of Belgium, who was also vying for it. He looked great, by the way, in the rounds. And so definitely a danger, a threat. But Bryce Hopple from the USA kind of going into this event looking like he's the guy to beat. He was looking great all season indoors, strong through the rounds, just like he's like in charge as he's racing. And I tell you what, I was so glad to see Bryce Hopple race a championship final like he races other races, which is like, I'm the man in charge. And he did just that, took charge. Final lap, he sits and waits and then passes and guns it, and nobody could stay close to him.
Yeah.
Like when he took off, it's not easy to do in an 800, but runs ended up running the fastest time in the world this year, just under 1:45 for a gold medal.
Yep. And it was only the third ever for US men in the 800. So this is the third
indoors.
Yeah. Yep. Of course, indoors. Yeah. Yeah, very exciting. So this is a fun fact. Hopple has won four US indoor 800 meter titles in a row, 2020, 2022, 2023, and 2024.
Yep.
And now he has a gold in the global realm. All right. Women's 800. This one was interesting. Notably, there's no Mary Mora, Athingmo, or Keely Hodgkinson.
None of the faves, but that's kind of how it goes.
Yeah, but that's okay because it gives us time to chat about some other really good talent in the 800 meter run. One that is fairly new to the 800 meters. In fact, the winner was new to the 800 meter run. Ethiopia's Sige Duguma, known as a 400 meter specialist, was the champion.
Not anymore.
Yeah, in 201. Oh. Yep.
So this was interesting, right? Andy just said kind of casually in 201, this was one of the slowest 800 meter championship races I've ever seen. Ever.
Yeah.
Like since the beginning of world championships.
But can I mention though, to Duguma's credit, she lowered her personal best to 158 in the semis.
Oh yeah. She can do
really
the fast
time. That's
yep.
faster than Mary Mora at this point in her career. Like, transitioning from the 400 to the 800, she has improved more quickly in the 800 than Mora.
Yeah, I guess the point is it's not a judgment necessarily of, well, actually to her credit for Duguma, because if you've got someone coming from a 400 meter specialty, chances are they've got some serious leg speed because, you know, the 400 requires a bit of leg speed. For all those other 800 meter specialists who just let the race be that slow, what were you thinking? Like, nobody wants to have to do that in an 800, but they did, and well, they all lost.
I guess if you're a 400-meter specialist, that makes a lot of sense that you want it to be
she just didn't
down
mind.
To the last sprint.
The reason why we're saying this, Duguma led the race, and she did not try to make it quick, but no one went around her. They just
they let her.
Sat in a little clump right behind her.
Gemma Reekie of Great Britain / Scotland, so she was the local
another
hometown
Scottish
hero.
Scottish native.
Took silver in 202, and then Benin's Noelle Yagiro earned her first medal of her career at the age of 38, which I love to hear. Very cool.
Always hope.
Yes, I love it.
Exciting.
First medal. And then 800. Like, that's a pretty short race for someone to be getting their first medal in their late 30s. So very neat.
And last up in the 1500 meters, which was also the event that concluded the championships.
Oh, sure. So we should switch and do the women's first.
Sure.
Let's do that.
My point is, that's uncommon for the 1500 to be the closing event. Is in some ways, it kind of feels like it's like the ultimate moment of the meet because it's like the end of it. And that's almost always the relay. But for some reason, they didn't this time. Anyway.
Women's 1500 meter run. Not a surprise win, not a surprise silver, but a surprise bronze for sure.
That's the truth.
Ethiopia's Frenny Hailu lived up to expectation by winning gold. She had the fastest 1500 meter run in the world in 2024 and won indoor.
We were talking about her earlier. She's undefeated all indoor season.
Yeah. Frenny Hailu is a force to be reckoned with, but also won world indoor silver at the 800 in 2022, so at the last world championships. She won at a time of 4:01.46. And American Nikki Hiltz was a strong contender going into the race to get the silver medal, which was awesome for Team USA. Hiltz was the American 1500 meter champion. This wasn't really a surprise.
No.
We thought that Nikki would be a strong contender in this race.
Aside from Hailu, Hiltz was likely to be able to beat everyone else in this race. Mm-hmm. And in particular, did it in the way you would expect, which is the race was not too terribly fast. And everyone had an opportunity to be close in the finish, which means it's a kicker's race, and Hiltz excels in a kicker's race.
Mm-hmm. The surprise really came from American Emily McKay, who led the race for part of the latter stages. She went from 7th to 1st, making gains around 1K, and then was overtaken at the end by Hiltz and Hailu, but hung on. For a bronze medal, it was perfect, really.
It was something.
Because I understand that feeling. I mean, not to this level, but listen, I ran the 1,000 in indoors when I was in college, and I was not the fastest girl. And so I, in the national race, took the lead knowing women would catch me, but knowing I had to give myself a chance.
And
by
all the rest
early.
Of us and his teammates were like, what is she doing?
It was my,
what is she doing?
It was for real. It was a strategy. I'm like, I know that they're faster, so I better go now and then get all American because people
you
are.
You say that in retrospect.
No,
I'm not
I did.
So sure that it was a deliberate strategy.
It was a deliberate strategy,
kidding.
Zach.
I get
and that's
you.
Why I wasn't afraid when they did pass me and just hung on to grab the best spot that I could and get the all American title. But
the
what
word
McKay did,
is bold. That's what this kind of a move is.
Yeah,
an
bold.
Unexpected, certainly not a favorite for the event. Taking charge in the not in the early but in the later stages of the race, that is bold.
Very bold. Yeah. That was fun. That was super fun. Two medals.
Two American medalists.
Fantastic.
And that didn't stop with the women's 1500 because in the men's 1500, things were just as exciting.
And this was a huge field because the fall happened in the prelims for the men's 1500. And so they had to bring them to the finals, like pass them through to the finals.
Yes.
So
okay.
That's
so that's thank you.
Yep.
That's what I was trying to remember. Yep. So in the preliminary round, one of the guys fell. Adam Fogg specifically. Shout out to Fogg. All right. So he fell, and when it's not so it was caused by other runners, right? When that happens, most of the time they will give that runner a pass through the round then. On account of the fact that you have no way of knowing how he actually would have been able to do because he was knocked down. So that means you got a little extra number of people in the final, which is fun in my book. That's exciting. But on an indoor track, it's a little bit tense. So big field, lots of guys, and not really clear who is the favorite in this particular instance. You recall Hobbs Kessler, the youngster from the United States at a fresh 20 years old, has been having a great indoor season. And I believe he's got the fastest time of the field in the world this year as well. So that means something, but he's a rookie when it comes to championship races, and that's no fault of his own. He's just new to the scene compared to a lot of these guys. You got Samuel Tefera in it, who once held the world record in the event indoors, also is no stranger to podiums in indoor track. So you've got the likes of other guys who have been doing this at a super high level, which is a threat. But what ends up happening is the race starts off, and, you know, after a little bit of shuffling and all that kind of stuff, Hobbs Kessler ends up in the lead, which is not where he intended to be. So you can see he's like looking around like, well, okay, what's happening here, guys? But no one wanted to take it from him. And Hobbs Kessler makes the decision. And you can tell when he made the decision and it was the right choice. And he said to himself, well, if I'm going to be in the lead, I'm going to stay out of trouble, run the easiest line on the track, and just run good, strong, comfortable, even effort. And if anyone wants to take it from me, you know, we'll just see what happens. But they don't take it from him. And so what they do is they let Hobbs Kessler run well within himself. He is not overexerting here. Well within himself in the best position in the race, which is entirely unobstructed. And it paid off well for Kessler. Now, unfortunately, he just didn't quite have the kick of some of the other guys. So when you get to the last lap, Kessler's still leading, but people are starting to challenge, but he's just continuing to hold his line, not let anyone around him. He's accelerating smoothly, gets to the last 75 meters, and then the big kickers come out.
Yep.
And Cole Hocker is known for his monster kick. He starts to let it out. Of course, he would say he let it out a little later than he planned to, but because he was stuck in the shuffle, which again, Kessler didn't have
to
deal
with. He's learning from, he said. Also.
Yeah. So Hocker starts making his move. It was pretty late, but it was clear that he was going to come on like a freight train. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, left field, Gordy Beamish with this kick like a bat out of hell comes down this straight, leaving everyone behind, barely catches them all by the time he gets to the line. But I don't know where he was when he started that kick, but he was nowhere in sight.
I can just tell you, this is what I can tell you. Okay, so Beamish was fifth at the final turn, okay? The final turn.
So that means under 100 meters to go.
Right. And Cole Hocker was fifth at the bell, so he had a lot of work to do, but Gordy Beamish had a ton of work to do at that final turn.
That's
how much faster he was closing.
Yeah, there's a funny series of screenshots that show Beamish at the bell lap, 200 meters to go, and it's like a seven. Question mark, like where is he even? You don't even really know because he's a non-factor. With 100 meters to go, half of the lap to go, there's basically another question mark. It's like, yeah, he's kind of there, but he's nowhere near the front of the race, and he's way outside in the track. And then last 25 meters, the dude is like, it looks like when he comes by, it looks like he's sprinting and everyone else is jogging.
And they were not.
Like, they're tired, they're fading or something like that, and he is just getting started. So then he proceeds to run a whole nother lap really fast while he's doing his victory stuff because he's clearly got a lot of energy left.
So cool.
It was exciting. So Gordy Beamish, On Athletics Club member, wins a global championship, his first medal in the world championships, in an event that is not his specialty.
Right, that's what I wanted to say. He's a 3,000-meter steeplechase specialist.
Now, he would say that, well, he was originally not. He was originally a miler.
Okay.
Because it is true. He joined the On Athletics Club as a miler, but Dathan directed him toward the steeple when it was clear that there might be something there worth exploring, and he ends up being, like, the best steepler in New Zealand history, among other accolades. And yet, gets to his roots a little bit here and ends up winning a global title.
Well, what's so humble of him, so humble, because he said in an interview, he's like, yeah, I'm still the fourth fastest guy on the fourth fastest miler on the OAC squad.
Yeah, I'm like, not like, even, you're the I'm one not even who top got three on my team. And yet,
he's the one who got the gold, though.
Well, what he's saying, though, what he's speaking to is what we keep mentioning kind of offhand, which is just the reality that it's true. The A-lister milers weren't in the race. I mean, you don't have Josh Kerr, who's the defending outdoor champion. You don't have Jakob Ingebrigtsen, who's won every other race except for the two that he lost. You don't have Jared Neguse, who's, you know, the fourth fastest miler of all time. And so, yeah, you could say that. And clearly, Beamish is being humble here, and he's recognizing that this is a different race if all those guys are in it. But they weren't, and he was. So he's got that medal.
Yep.
And he gets to keep it.
And he showcased something really special, which he was in a race with really good kickers, and his dazzled.
What a kick.
It was really thrilling to watch.
So as it stacks up, it was Cole Hocker for the silver and Hobbs Kessler in his first podium finish for a bronze. U.S. taking two medals home, two in the men's, two in the women's. And then you've got the 3,000s with a couple medals and an 800 medal. And it amounts to the United States distance runners, middle distance runners, you could say, were just rocking it.
Showed up.
So, yeah, we kind of like the USA. We support those runners. And that was exciting. We had a blast watching this
one. We know that our listeners are all over the world. So we do recognize that there's a lot of great showings from many countries, but We were especially excited to see our homeboys win.
That's right. All right. Well, let's talk about one more here. We got the Tokyo Marathon. We're going to do this briefly if we can, but it was a crazy event. And as such, we definitely need to report on it. First of all, major upsets. There were anticipated things that did not come to fruition. Namely, Eliud Kipchoge is in the race. Every time he's in a race, you know that people are talking about it, as well they should. And Sifan Hassan for the women. And she's won two out of two marathon majors that she has run so far. And it doesn't look like she's stopping anytime soon. You know, Sifan Hassan basically can win anything, anytime. So she didn't this time, though, and neither did Kipchoge. What it amounted to actually was kind of interesting, but neither of the two of them were really in the race come halfway. They were already fading and just continued to go backwards. And there's a few reasons for that. These were fast races, to be sure. The men went out on world record pace and stayed on it for a while, so that's going to certainly thin the troops. And the women, you've got the upper echelon of marathoners right now duking it out, and it could be anyone's day. And it wasn't Hassan's this time.
Did you read much about like what Hassan like was going into the race thinking? Because I know she's going to go for track, outdoor track as well. So maybe this was a race where she was paid a lot for appearance.
Did they say she was? Did she say she's running the Olympics on the track or in the marathon?
I think she said she was doing...
Or both.
Well, I thought she... Well, okay. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Okay, I'd like to hear more from her because, you know, sometimes she does things like, you know, I'm training for outdoor track, but I'm going to run this marathon in between, you know?
Well, yeah, but she did that in one London. So, and then proceeded to win Chicago a few months later. But maybe
she's also human and...
But only sometimes. Okay, so point being, there were other people taking charge this time around, and they weren't terribly surprising necessarily either. So on the men's side, if Kipchoge was, you know, certainly one to talk about, Benson Kipruto is dominant on the World Marathon Majors circuit, in particular in Boston and Chicago. He has finished top three 5 times in World Marathon Majors,
wow.
Twice in Chicago, 3 times in Boston. He's also won both of them once. And so Kipruto is never someone to take for granted on this stage. And he showed up, and he showed up big. This now marks his third Marathon Majors victory, winning Tokyo, winning it in a course record time, in a Japan all-comers record time. Fastest on Japanese soil, and did so in 2:02.16. Good for number five on the all-time list.
Wow.
Also nearly a 2-minute personal best.
2 minutes.
Now, Tokyo is not known to be world record quality course. And yet, this dude who's world class just ran nearly 2 minute PR.
It was a fast day though, right? Overall,
it was a fast day. Okay. So something was in the water, in the weather. They had the right conditions, no doubt about it. Because not only that, so he ran almost a 2 minute personal best to win the race, get the Tokyo or Japan all comers time, which is incredible. That was, by the way, Kipchoge's time from last time he ran Tokyo. So he bested Kipchoge's course record. Really good stuff. But then also, in second place, Timothy Kiplagat of Kenya, also of Kenya, ran a personal best 2:02.55, blazing fast. And this marks now his fifth marathon personal best in a row.
That's a great trend.
And every single time it's been between 60 and 90 seconds. He's just chopped another 60 seconds up to 90 seconds off, another 60 seconds off. As a matter of fact, Kiplagat has never not run a personal best in a large marathon.
Ooh, we got to get him on the show.
This is very interesting.
That is interesting.
So now here he finds himself second in Tokyo. He's got 2:02.55 for his personal best. And you just got to wonder,
wowzer,
when's the trend going to stop, if ever?
I love the trend.
Right, yeah. On the women's side, as mentioned, Hassan wasn't a factor after about halfway. But the three women duking it out, it was kind of like an anyone's game kind of scenario.
Yeah. So over the final 10K, Sutum Assefa Kebebe of Ethiopia just put some distance on the others.
They were going back and forth. They were staying tight. And then Kebebe made some moves. Others started to fade a little, and she took charge.
Previous best majors was third in Tokyo in 2020. So, yep.
But not necessarily. She hasn't had a lot of majors finishes in the last few years. And you wonder, injury, things like that, potentially. But she was ready for it this time.
Yeah. Ran a personal best by 2 minutes.
Which is just over?
That's significant at this point. And when they get this fast, a couple minutes is a lot. Also, a course and Japan all-comers record. Wow.
So
fast day.
That's why we say, okay, something was going on this day, because not only Kipruto did so in the men's race, but Kebebe did so as well in the women's race. And that time of 2:15.55 is number 8 all-time on the women's list. And then the top three women were all under 2:17.
That is a fast race, folks.
Yeah. So Rosemary Wanjiru, who's the defending Tokyo champ, finished second, only 20 seconds behind. And then the 2023 World Marathon Championships champion, Amane Bariso from Ethiopia, was third, also just a hair under 2:17. So you got some good things going for you. Sifan Hassan ended up fourth, by the way. She was not too far out of it, but 2:18 and change.
Okay, that's good. What's also good is America's very own Betsy Sena was fifth, running a time of 2:19.17, just shy of Kira D'Amato's time, making her third all-time for the USA.
That's amazing.
That's so good.
So Tokyo was the race to run.
Seriously.
But now it's over. So
which is
you
crazy.
Can't
you know, like Sena, like she's not going to be representing Team USA at the Olympics, but she's this good. I mean, that just goes to show that the Olympic trials are really exciting, and we have a lot of great talent in the USA. Because Betsy Sena is showing that she's world class.
That's also why a lot of people argue for scrapping the U.S. Olympic trials and deciding the marathon team based on seasons, not based on a single race and less than normal experiences.
Jared Ward, I guess, spoke to this because this has been a conversation because I guess it was a huge expense and was very difficult for Orlando. So we don't know if there's anyone who's going to want to host the Olympic trials.
So, yeah, the rule of hosting the Olympic trials is, one, you're going to lose a ton of money, and two, you're going to make a lot of people mad no matter what you do. The people in the city, the people doing the event.
Well, it's because I guess I was reading that like USATF does not give the money for the winnings, and they are so that the host city does all of that, and then accommodations for all of the USATF officials and all of the athletes. So it's a very big ordeal for a hosting city logistically as well as financially. So it's just a strain on the organizers to put it all together like this. And then the reward is not as big as what we would hope, as all of us are fans of the sport, but we need to grow that.
There is no reward for the hosting organization. It's just for the sake of the athletes and the experience. But
yeah. So Jared Ward then spoke to the fact that really it's helpful to have a championship style race like that that's kind of brutal in some regards, because it does end up yielding really good finishes at the Olympics. Like, a lot of times the people who run fast at the Olympic trials outperform their best times, like in a sense of a placement. So like
they outperform their ranking.
They outperform, that's what I meant. Most of the time. Thank you. You're helping me out here. Yeah. They outperform their ranking, and we have medalists and we have top 10 finishers where it would on paper not look like we would. So he says that he thinks that the Olympic trials yields great racers.
Yeah. I'm not optimistic though that it's going to continue as such. Either way, we really enjoyed it and certainly hope it does continue for the sake of that experience. But on that note, remember that we want your questions. So go ahead and email us. The email address is questions@A2ZRunning.com so that we can feature those thoughts next time around.
Thank you all for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.